This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Women in Politics, that's the theme of today's show. I'm featuring a new piece by Dr. Jocelyn Parkhurst of Lewis Clark State College. She's taking an interesting tact in her research and exploring two types of national policies, individualistic and maternal, and how people in these kinds of countries view women, particularly how they view women in politics. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is called All Politics. A number of women have run for president of the United States. Installment number one gives us an overview of these Wonder Women. Women have been running for president of the United States for more than 100 years. Yes, that's right. Hillary's not the first. When it comes to U.S. presidential leaders, many other women have logged firsts, starting with Victoria Woodhull. She ran for president in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket. Yes, that's 1872. She lost to a fellow Ohioan, Ulysses S. Grant. 12 years later, Belva Lockwood ran for president in 1884 and again in 1888. From then on, the late 1800s until 1960, only one other woman was proposed as presidential candidate, and that was Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman for president ran across the front of a 1943 Marvel comic book. But it also said in the small print that this was Wonder Woman 1,000 years in the future. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the presidential attempts by women picked up. After a number of women served in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate in state legislatures, as governors and as mayors. 1960, Whitney H. Slocum ran for president under the Greenback Party. Then in 1964, Margaret Chase Smith ran. She was a Republican, member of the House of Representatives from 1940 to 49, and senator from 49 to 1973. But in 64, she was presidential candidate in the primary elections. In 1968, Charlene Mitchell. But then in 1972, things really picked up for women with four, count 'em, four female presidential candidates. Patsy Takamoto Mink, Bella Savitsky Abzug, Bella Abzug, Linda Osteen Jenness, and the renowned Shirley Anita St. Hill Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm was the first female black member of the House of Representatives, and she served 14 years from 1968 through 82. She was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination at the Democratic Party convention. Here she is at the convention.
I will not camouflage or support the forces that wish this country to become an undemocratic influence in the community of the world of nations. Here at home, I will tell the truth about the poverty and hardships suffered by so many of our citizens, not just the minority or jobless group traditionally thought of as poor and deprived, but the working poor as well, the millions of men and women who work hard and constantly, but still cannot make enough to decently clothe, house, and feed themselves and their families. I will tell the truth about the visible differences of race and sex that have been used to isolate women of all racial groups and minority men as an unpaid or underpaid source of labor, whether they are working in factories or fields, in their own kitchens or other people's kitchens, in office buildings or in government agencies and on college campuses. I will tell the truth about the big corporations the defense industries, the utilities, the railroads, the airlines, and the agribusiness powers that are the true welfare recipients. The taxpayer spends far more for these corporate subsidies than she or he does for the so-called welfare recipient, the individual who simply cannot get the training or opportunity necessary to support themselves and their families.
Now, after Shirley Chisholm ran, more female candidates continued to seek the U.S. presidency. 1976, Margaret Wright and Ellen McCormick. Ellen McCormick, by the way, was the first woman to receive matching funds. She appeared on the ballot in 18 states and received a total of 267,590 votes in the primaries and 22 votes from delegates at the Democratic National Convention. And she engaged in a debate with President Jimmy Carter. In 1980, Ellen McCormick ran again and was joined in the race by Deirdre Griswold and Maureen Smith. In 1984, even more, Sonia Johnson with running mate Emma Wong Marr. And Isabel Masters, who didn't give up, she ran again in 1992, 96, 2000, and 2004. Gabrielle Holmes with running mate Gloria E. La Rivera. And in 1984, also Patricia Scott Schroeder. Congresswoman Pat Schroeder was Democratic candidate for the nomination in the primary elections, but she did withdraw from the race before the party convention. The first Democratic woman to actually appear on the ballot paper was Geraldine Ferraro, who was vice presidential candidate in 1984 as Walter Mondale's running mate. They lost to Ronald Reagan, but the fervor over her candidacy was great. Here's Geraldine Ferraro at the Democratic convention.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro. Proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us. As I stand before the American people and think of the honor this great convention has bestowed upon me, I recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who made America stronger by making America more free. He said, "Occasionally in life, there are moments which cannot be completely explained by words. Their meaning can only be articulated by the inaudible language of the heart. Tonight is such a moment for me. My heart is filled with pride. My fellow citizens, I proudly accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
Geraldine Ferraro and Pat Schroeder generated excitement. Serious women candidates. Yet after the fervor and the losses, things slowed down for women seeking that highest office. The ranks of senator, congresswoman, governors, and state representatives and mayors were growing, however, slow and steady. And this probably fed the growth that was seen among presidential female candidates three elections later. In 1988, we only had two. In 1992, Gloria La Rivera, Susan Block, Helen Betty Halyard, and Millie Howard. 1996 set records for women candidates. I counted 11, if I got it right. In the year 2000, Elizabeth Hanford Dole led the women candidates, all 12 of them. She had served as assistant to the president for public liaison, secretary of transportation, and secretary of labor. Her husband, former Senator Bob Dole, was the Republican presidential candidate in 96. 4 years later, Elizabeth Dole ran, but she did withdraw from the Republican convention because of lack of funding. In 2002, she was elected senator for North Carolina. Also in the running in 2000, among some 200 candidates who had registered for presidential elections in one or more states, were Kathy Gordon Brown with VP running mate Sabrina R. Allen, Temperance Alicia Lance Council, Paula E. Bennett, Deborah Katz Puschel, Angel Joy Rocker, Dorian Yeager, Rachel One Family Miller, Raj Allison Officewala, Gloria Dawn Strickland, Linda D. Blodgett, Sandra S. Duffy, Johanna Joan Malone. Johanna Joan Malone ran again in 2004, along with a large group of female candidates. Another large group of female candidates. And that group of 2004 was Mildred Williams Glover, Janine Shabib, Georgia Howe, Melanie Pridgen, Diana Ramsey Rasmussen Kennedy IV, Deborah Elaine Allen, Joy Elena Graham Pendergast, Jackie Hayward, Deborah Joyce Renderos, Nancy Warwick, and a name you might recognize, Carol Moseley Braun, the first African-American woman to serve in the U.S. Senate and former ambassador to New Zealand. A country which, by the way, has a female prime minister currently, the Right Honorable Helen Clark. Here's a portion of Carol Moseley Braun's stump speech from August 2003. It sounds like something that could be used today.
We've gone since 9/11 in a situation in which some folks have figured out that if they pander to our fear, they can push an extreme right-wing agenda, not only here, but abroad. What was supposed to have been a war on terrorism turned into a misadventure, just running out, you know, in Iraq, doing whatever. I mean, we still, think about it. When was the last time you heard Bin Laden's name? Think of who? Ben who? Ben missing. Our young men and women put in harm's way for no real rational reason. And now, and even though the aircraft carrier and the war is supposed to be over, we're still hearing horrible reports coming back. All those people, you know, remember old Europe and the people we thumbed our noses at? Now we're saying, well, maybe we do need you all's help after all. Well, you know, this is no way to interface and interact with the rest of the world. At a time when the challenges facing us are global in nature, we can't solve SARS and AIDS and poverty and globalization going it by ourselves, tell them to bring it on. We've got to work well with others. We've got to work with the rest of the world and the leadership of the rest of the world to raise up those values that made this the greatest country and that make us proud to be Americans. 2004 will be a time for us to make a decision. What path will we go down? Will we continue to let the fear mongers and the hate mongers and the people who divide and who pick fights dominate our politics and direct our direction into the next century? Or will we choose to embrace that which is best about this country, build community, and engage with the rest of the world in behalf of a future that we'll be proud to have left in our time? That's the issue. And that is why I've stepped forward to run for President of the United States. This is a very serious candidacy and a very serious campaign. As you've heard from the introduction, I am as credentialed as any of the fellas and more than most.
Each year, there are fewer and fewer first steps available thanks to these women. Each woman to run stands on the shoulders of her predecessors and gets higher and higher each time. And each one breaks new boundaries. Each one is a Wonder Woman. This is Yin Radio. Today's show is All Politics. Installment number 2, The Political Image of Women. Dr. Jocelyn Parkhurst is a political science professor at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho. Drawing from the research by Eileen McDonough, Jocelyn's research seeks to test her hypothesis that only what is called a hybrid state can adequately include women in the highest political offices. Hybrid states include both the male aspect of the political world through individualism and the female political aspect of the world through maternal policies. Jocelyn Parkhurst will be testing McDonough's theory by viewing the political image of women. Installment number 2 comes from Jocelyn Parker's presentation for Women's History Month at Lewis Clark State College in March 2010, where she described the hybrid state and the image of woman in politics.
I'm going to be presenting on some research that I am working on. It started probably about 3 years ago when I first did a brown bag lunch that was exploring the idea of women and politics and why don't we have women as political leaders in the United States? And it was before the election that happened in 2008. And so it was like looking at, does Hillary Clinton have a chance? Then last year I did another presentation that explored this idea of women as the image of women in the political world. And what is it that, is there something about this image that makes it more difficult for women to be able to become elected into office, especially for the presidency in those high offices? And really, it was much more of just an exploration last year of, okay, these are the images that I'm seeing, and mostly I kind of picked the negative ones. And does this then kind of inform us and tell us how we are viewing women differently than men? Then last fall, I taught a women and politics course. And we first explored the idea of the things that influence women to take the kind of political views that they do, and the difficulty it is for them to get into office. A lot of that had to do with the socialization and those kinds of processes. And then we looked at a book by Eileen McDonough, and it's called The Motherless State. And we all kind of went, this kind of makes a little bit of sense. And so using that, and I'm going to explain it here just a little bit further, I started to work up a methodology in being able to really look at this idea of the political image of woman and how it affects women being able to be elected in different states. As we've looked throughout this method for women's history, we've been often left out of the political process. Women are often left out. Even today, we're only around 18% in the national government as far as women elected into office in the Senate and in the House. We've never elected a female head of state or head of government, and women don't tend to enter into the political world to the same extent that men do. And so then is the question, why? I'm going to do this presentation and hopefully a discussion at the end, again, as a result of the things that I talked about, the different presentations I've done, and the Women in Politics class that we've done, that I did last fall. And I think that the factor that influences to a large degree is this image, is this political image of woman. What happens is that women have to do two things in order to be seen as acceptable as a candidate. First, they have to show how much they're like a man, how much they can have authoritative voice, that they know the topic, that they know the issues, that they are competitive in this race that we have in order to be elected. So first they have to do that. Then women still have to show how they're still feminine, how they are still a woman. So they have two aspects that they have to show. Eileen McDonough calls this the hybrid candidate, that they have to have both sides. Men don't. Men only have to show the male side, and that's what's different between the two. But not all states match the hybrid candidate in being a hybrid state. What we look at is, when we talk about a hybrid state, it's a state that has two different aspects to it. Individualist types of policies, and I'll get to those, but also maternal state policies. Now, maternal has a little bit of baggage with it, that idea of, you know, motherly and maternal kinds of stuff. But if you just sort of let the baggage go a little bit and consider that these are policies that are nurturing in some way, that they're not that individualist that I'll get to kinds of policies, but they are the state taking an action that helps the population in some way in that maternal aspect. Often we see it in welfare policies. A lot of people in here understand the difference between our sort of layman's idea of what we call welfare and the academic aspect of welfare. Welfare means well-being, that we think that people should have a certain standard of living, that they need to have certain things in life in order to be able to find what happiness is, to be able to function in society. It's when we talk about the welfare state and welfare policies, we're not just talking about money going to somebody. That's sort of the image that we have of that in the United States. But it's much broader than that when we look at it in that academic term of the welfare state and welfare policies. These are policies that are seen as nurturing to the population as a caregiver. Often it's universal health care, education through K through university, child care by a parent at home. Scandinavian countries, if you've ever looked at them, they have a strong welfare state that really has a lot of these kinds of policies. The other kind of thing that they look at for maternal state policies are gender quotas. This can be gender quotas that are set that so many women have to be elected into, let's say, the Senate or the House. It can also be gender quotas that simply allow, that simply say, that a party says itself, we're going to have so many women on the ballot. And they make that gender quota for themselves in that party. And then a historical monarchy, interestingly enough. This, again, is what Eileen McDonough looks at. She says that this is some of the earliest ways that the state took on that maternal aspect, that caregiver aspect, is through the monarchy. Because even though it has that idea of being, you know, that one controlling factor, it takes on that nurturing aspect. The monarch is supposed to be taking care of its citizens. And also, you also found more women being able to become leaders through the monarchy at an earlier state than through democracies. So she looks at that too. And as well, most, a lot of times, the women were the mothers of the kings or the emperors, and they often had some political power in that role as well. So that's what Eileen McDonough looks at when it comes to maternal state policies. Individualist state policies, there tends to be a clear separation between the public and the private world. If you look at the United States, we tend to, especially at the early part of our history, have that clear separation between what is politics, what is supporting that individual to be able to partake in the political world and the economy with as little government as possible, versus what we put into the private world, which was a lot of those social policy things that we've looked at, that we often see from the maternal state policies. Policies that support economic development without state involvement, focus on property, ownership, individual responsibility, limited social welfare programs. Social welfare programs that are seen to benefit those who have paid in are seen to be okay, but those for people in need are bad. For example, often Social Security is considered to be okay as a social welfare program, but welfare and food stamps, there's a stigmatism on those ones when it comes to having to be in need. So, the state makeup influences women as political leaders. A state that tends to follow individualist policies often fails to value the nurturer or the caregiver image of the state. In a lot of the discussions you've heard about universal health care or health care insurance, really, in the United States, you know, there's all this socialism, we're moving to socialism, and it was like this bad, bad thing that the state should be seen as a caregiver in some way. So in that way, that image is of the caregiver state is not accepted in that individualistic sense. And in the same way, what she argues is then that caregiver aspect of women is often then put on a low burner. It's not valued as well when it comes to them as being political leaders. A state that tends to include maternal state policies values both the individualist and the caregiver view of the state. This type of state tends to value both sides, both the individualist and that maternal caregiver aspect of the state's, that is part of the state's role in society. And in that way, it is going to value then those aspects in women to a larger degree as political leaders. So she argues then that the hybrid state, that state that includes both the individualist and as well as the maternal state policies, is going to be much more accepting to women as political leaders because it's a hybrid state and women then have to be hybrid candidates. So it's a much better match between the two. You always start off the year, you know, thinking, I'm going to do this wonderful research and I'm going to get it all done and be able to present it all, and it never works out that way. But Jamie Johnson and I are working on still collecting data and information on trying to compare the United States and Canada. So I don't actually have very much of that today, but you are going to get a fair amount of where I'm going through with my methodology and sort of, you know, where I first started my thought processes. But when you look at Canada, it does have a historical monarchy. You know, it is the British Crown is the head of state in Canada. The head of government is their prime minister, and the Queen is the head of state. Gender quotas, the two of their top four parties have gender quotas for putting people on the ballot, for putting women on the ballot. Canada has a strong social policy agenda, and its constitution supports the idea of the state as a provider of welfare. So Canada is seen as having more of those kinds of policies that include that maternal aspect of the state. So it tends to be fit much more over on the hybrid side of the scale than the individualist side. On the other hand, you have the United States. The United States has no historical monarchy. When we first started, you know, with the Constitution at least, in, what was it, 1789, there is a clear separation, again, between the public and private world, between the individualist type policies and the maternal policies. Maternal went to the social world. You know, that was taken on by charities or by religious groups or by individual people or by families, a lot of those social kinds of programs. Well, we really held dearly to the individualist kinds of policies. Again, a clear separation between the two realms of public and private. I'll put my little tidbit in there that, you know, women also were very much a part of the revolution at that time, and they, in their support of and in their activism that we don't always see in the textbooks today, but very much, from what I can tell, they were left out of the discussion of what the political world was going to ultimately look like. And so the structures that were put in without their voice. So that's my side note. No gender quotas. We don't have quotas, and people are very firm. No quotas here in the United States. So we're very strongly against the idea of having any kind of gender quotas. Limited social welfare policies. Even the health care insurance policy that has passed is an insurance policy. I don't see it as being a social welfare program to the degree that I would see in other countries. It's really, you have to buy insurance, and maybe we'll help you a little bit buying the insurance. But it's not what I would call universal health care insurance. It doesn't have the public option. There's a lot of limitations on it when it comes to the idea of universal health care. Even and that debate was so interesting in how much people said, well, we need to work on this. We need to work on this. Yet when it came to the state moving beyond its role in that individualist policy arena to taking on that caregiver role, it was like, well, wait a second. You know, that's socialism. We can't go there. So it's the debate itself lent us to an idea of how we, you know, as a population, view the state as not being a caregiver to the people. testing the theory, the political image of women. If Eileen McDonough is correct in what she says, then there should be a difference in the political image of women between Canada and the United States. So what Eileen McDonough says is that there is this difference between the United States and Canada, that Canada is a hybrid state, United States is not. Therefore, women should be more accepted as political leaders in that public image in Canada than in the United States. Now, the difficulty is how do you measure that from my theoretical perspective of using image theory, and I'm going to explain image theory as well here. She does it by looking at, again, the sort of number aspects of gender quotas, social welfare policies, historical monarchy, and that's where she comes up with the division between which states are individualist and which states are hybrid states, which are and which aren't. But I'm going to say, okay, those numbers are really cool, but is that really the way it is? You know, is there a difference in the image of women as political leaders? So this goes back to my theoretical background, which is image theory. This is what I've been working with when I did my dissertation on image theory. I applied it to dependent of the enemy and rogue states and this transition between them. But I originally went back to school to sort of involve myself in women and their political power. So I wanted to sort of take that theoretical framework and apply it to women and politics in some way. So images develop out of a response to information about an object or phenomena. Basically, what happens is we create images or schemas all the time from the information and stimulus that we get in our environment. It's something we have to do. One of the examples I use is you've got a child, and you're going into a restaurant with the child. And the child goes running in and starts running off to the table. And you're like, no, wait, here, see, it says we have to wait to be seated. And so you wait there with the child, then you go and you sit, and the child sits down, she starts, you know, saying, I want, and she goes, no, let's look at the menu first. So you pull out the menu, and you have a menu, and the child starts to, you know, decide what he or she wants. And then, you know, they're getting ready to go, and they're like, gonna run out, and they're like, no, we have to pay. You know, and then there's the tip, and they're learning all of this. So the next time they come in, the child automatically stops and waits. Well, maybe not. My kid probably wouldn't. But, you know, they're like more likely to stop, you know, and say, okay, I need to sit, you know, wait to be seated, you know, and then they know that there's going to be a menu. You know, they learn that schema, that process, that framework of how to interact in that situation. Well, that's what we do with all kinds of stuff, and especially when it comes to relating to people in some way or states, which is what image theory originally was for, is in creating images about states so that it helps fill in information gaps. Information that's processed through schemas, in turn, help us make decisions in the future. New information, basically what happens is you create that schema or that structure, and then new information comes in, and it's filtered through that information system. So it helps, again, to fill in missing information where you might have blanks of information. Each person develops their own worldview through this process. The worldview that I have for about life and the world around me is going to be different from other people because my experiences in life are different from each one of you. We create this worldview or this image of the world around us. Now, even though we have our own different worldviews as individuals, there's going to be a certain amount of that information that's held in common between all of us. And that is what we call having like-minded individuals. Image theory looks at the images or perceived images that people have, like-minded groups of people have of an event or of a state or of a population of people. We tend to like the images or schemas that we have. We tend to hold on to them very tightly. Even when we have new information coming in that goes against what we think is right or against that schema, we will try to hold on to that worldview very tightly. Sometimes if it's enough information, we might say, okay, I need to rethink this situation a little bit. Other times we will try to cram that worldview into what we already know and try and fit it in there somehow. Or we'll start to devalue that information. We'll say, I'm not going to listen to that. That's wrong. You don't know what you're saying. You know, and so in some way we have to fit or reject that that new information from our worldview. One of the things that I have found in my research from my dissertation is that when you have an emotion attached to that new information, you're much more likely to change your worldview, either positive or negative. If you thought about the world in a way that something like nonviolence, let's say, you really believed in nonviolence, but something really bad happened to you that created a negative, you know, emotion in your life, you might be more inclined to change that worldview because of that emotion that was attached to it, rather than just having information thrown at you. So in the past, image theory tended to be applied to the decision policymakers made towards other countries. Like I said, towards things like you could have the image of the ally state or the enemy state, the rogue state. We have the terrorist state today. And that, again, would be a way of, that's an image that we have in the United States. If we say, what's a terrorist state? Well, we're going to think Iran and maybe a couple other states. That's exactly what I'm talking about having an image. And then when you think about that, when you say a terrorist state, there's like this whole little, you know, identification of what a terrorist state, you know, in your mind, you know, if I said, okay, what's a terrorist state? You would be able to say, well, it's this, 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 and this, right? You'd come up with this idea of what it is. And to a certain degree, we might all kind of feel the same way about what that definition is, the same thing with an enemy or an ally state. So what I want to do with this is take that idea of image, that worldview image of what we have as the political woman, and look at that between Canada and the United States. I believe that we have, you know, generally speaking, of course there's going to be certain levels of difference between someone who's more conservative versus someone who's more liberal versus a feminist versus someone who's not. You know, there are going to be differences that I'm going to have to also capture as well. But there has to be out there somewhere this image of the political woman to be able to look at and see, is there a difference of that image between the United States and Canada? The difficulty is trying to measure that image. Basically, I'm going to be looking at women, and we want to uncover that a like-minded individual. The exploration will consider two groups, media professionals, and the general population. The general population is going to be a little bit more difficult to really try and get a hold of as to what they're thinking. My idea is that at some point in the future, what I'd like to do is to do some videotape personal interviews with people and put that together as some kind of a documentary, as a collage or something like that. And I think that would be kind of cool to take a look at, again, looking at between the United States and Canada. Then at the same time, I think that media often represents some of our thoughts. Yes, some media formats are trying to inform us or they're trying to persuade us to think a certain way, but I also do think that media has a way of trying to express some of the views that we have in the United States. Some of the things that I'm going to be looking at will be cartoons from newspapers, as well as different like comedy shows or other shows that describe and discuss women. Yes, most of those are going to be picking apart, you know, different kind of characteristics, but then I can go back and I can say, okay, is it similar or different than the way that, one, that they do that with men, and then, two, is it similar or different, you know, between the United States and Canada? As well as then also trying to look into some more public commentaries from different sources. What I have on here to show you sort of as some of the first little steps of looking at this political image of woman from the 2008 election. We're looking mostly at Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, so we can kind of get an idea of some of these images that we're seeing out there. So ultimately, my thesis or hypothesis is generally going to be that a state that has a historical monarchy, quotas for women, office holders, and maternal policies is more likely to have a positive political image of women, while a state that does not have an historical monarchy, refuses to enact quotas, and follows individualist policies only, will be more likely to have a less positive political image of women. I really thank you all for coming and exploring this with me and letting me share where I'm going with my research. So thank you very much.
Dr. Jocelyn Parkhurst is an assistant professor in political science at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho. University of Idaho professor Sandra Reinecke gives us a different take on the representation of women in U.S. office.
Statistics on female political representation in the United States look grim, and I brought along some statistics in case we want to look it up. But if the United States is so far down in terms of women's representation in elected offices, who do you think is the country in the world that has the highest representation of women in its elected office? I'm sorry?
Finland.
Finland? Did you say Finland? Finland is probably number three. The first one is Rwanda. Oftentimes we just apply these stereotypical ideas about how the world is run and what it looks like. And when you look at a map, for instance, that tells you in terms of shades who runs a country, sometimes we are surprised, for instance, surprised by the small amount of women who are involved in politics in the United States. Overall, in the United States, we have a representation of about 35%. In Sweden, it's 45%. The issue here is the challenge that women face in order to become elected into representative office. And I wanted to propose three angles how to understand this. The first is, why don't we have more women in elected office? Are they not voting, or are they not even there? So we have, of course, the majority of U.S. citizens are women. The majority of voters are women. Women tend to vote in higher numbers than men. We have, in the 2000 election, we had 61% women participating and 58% men turning out to cast their vote. Women, on the other hand, contribute less to campaigns, and they contribute less dollars to campaigns as well. But they turn out in higher percentages to cast their ballot. However, women do tend to vote for the left party. And why do you think that is?
Social issues such as welfare reform, healthcare, abortion rights.
And to add to it, socioeconomic status. Women make less money than men, generally, so they tend to favor, in this country, the Democratic Party. So here you, if you do your math, more women, more women voters, more left-leaning women should give you an idea of how this election comes up. Apparently, it's still a puzzle. We talk about political representation. Once we looked at political participation, we look at political representation. So the question that everybody asks is, do women have a particular interest that they want their representative towards, for instance, the social issues that you just mentioned? And if women have a woman issue, would women represent these issues better, for instance, in Congress or in the Senate or as a president and so forth? Okay. And then, of course, if women actually were to represent women's issues better, how many of them do you have in order to achieve this? Do you have to have 50% of them, or 68, or 79.5? So these are the kind of questions that political scientists ask themselves. Does mass matter? Do we have to have a critical mass of female representatives in order to change policy? Because just the liking for a candidate and voting for her does not necessarily make a policy change. So we wonder, if we need more women, what's the critical mass that we need in order to change policy? And here, what is in disfavor of women representation in elected office is, for instance, the electoral system in the countries that we're looking at. In the United States, you have what we call a single district electoral system. The winner takes all. And so parties are more reluctant to put a woman in there because the assumption is that she's not able to win over the male candidate, then you're losing the entire district. Whereas countries such as Sweden, Finland, and so forth, who have a higher representation of women in elected office, they have a multiple district electoral system. Don't blame it on men, blame it on the electoral system.
That was Sandra Reinecke. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho.
We have one more segment on today's show, and it's a quite involved segment. But our question around town was, would you vote for a woman president? And also, when elected, do you think women govern differently than men do?
Yes, I would vote for a woman for president. She would have to have my kind of politics, which is to say, middle of the road to liberal, not going to vote for a radical writer. So if she had those qualities, I probably would vote for the man. But if she had, you know, my kind of politics, for sure. I think we're ready. I think we need it as a country.
Do you think that women elected to office govern differently than men?
In some cases, yes. But I've had experiences here in Florida that have told me no.
Would you vote for a woman for president?
Absolutely.
And under what conditions?
If her politics matched my politics and I believed in the same thing she did, anything I would vote for a man, I don't see any difference.
And do you think a woman elected to office governs differently than a man?
I think that yes. I mean, inherently men and women are different, so I think whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't think it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, it would be different, but change needs to happen. So.
Absolutely
not. No, if she was the best candidate running, we'd vote for
the woman.
It would
choose the lesser of two evils.
And what was your answer? Hold up toward her. I didn't understand that.
I said absolutely none, but like they said, the lesser of two evils.
But you're going to get some controversial.
No conditions.
Oh, okay.
Pretty much.
Oh, okay. I wasn't. That's what I wasn't saying. If you would absolutely not vote for her, or if you would under absolutely no conditions.
Yeah, if it were between, you know, a lady and a witch, I'd vote for the lady. You know. But, you know, it would just, it's kind of one of those questions that until you know more of the circumstances, you can't say yes or no.
But we're pretty conservative, so our answers are going to be conservative.
Yes.
So.
More or less conservative.
Well, do you think women govern differently than men when elected to office?
Perhaps, but men govern differently than each other, so there's really no saying, you know, women are different. They're
not across the board. Because there's been a lot of women that did a really good job, like Queen Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II and Margaret Thatcher, and they did really good jobs, but I wouldn't say it's like the ideal situation, just for various reasons.
Maybe you want to expand? You don't have to, but if you wanted to expand, I'm curious.
It's actually
just because women are more geared towards, you know, TLC and that kind of stuff, and it's just rougher on them to be out in those kind of situations. Guys are just more wired for that kind of thing. You know, but there are women who can do it.
Well, it's one of those things that the founding fathers didn't think to specify in the Constitution, but it seems like something, like, okay, they didn't specify that a dog couldn't be president, but it's like, well, because, you know, it's like, obviously not. So that's going to be a very controversial point, but
not
it just seems that...
Dogs.
No,
that was a very drastic example to get across the point.
Yeah, no, we're not against women.
We're women.
Cool. Did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, basically, as a Christian, we believe that women should not be in that position.
Under what circumstances would you vote for a woman for president?
Any.
Yeah. But
I vote
I believe
for the pure fact.
Yeah, I think that she has to be a good candidate. You know, I mean, compared to everyone else, it doesn't matter if you're a man or woman. But, yeah, I'd still probably vote for her out of everyone, just because.
I'd vote just because.
Well, this is going to really tick you off, because I don't vote anymore. I figure one liar is as good as the other, and I just don't care to vote for any liars anymore. And I wish the whole country would stop voting and just let them know that we don't like them. However, since we live in the country we live in, yeah, I would vote for a woman. Darn right I would vote for a woman if I felt that she was reasonably trustworthy. I know it's a game they have to play, but I just don't deal very well with politics anymore. I try to totally keep that out of my life. It's just too upsetting to know that we have liars and cheats and thieves running the country. I'm sorry, that's my personal opinion.
Do you think, when elected to office, that women do or would govern differently than men do?
Still too much game playing going on.
Sure, I'd vote for a president of the United States if she were a woman. And I don't think that there's any, I don't have any preconceived ideas about a person needing to have special qualities to be president. seems to me that women have the desirable qualities in at least as much quantity as men do. I think women, when elected, maybe would like to govern differently than men. And I think they probably try to be more human when they govern. But unless there is unless we have more women involved in politics, I think women who are elected find that they have to play by the rules that are set up by the men in order to get anything done. So I'd certainly like to see a lot more women involved in the legislature and as governors and so on, because then the rules might have a chance of changing.
What would it take for you to vote for a woman for president?
Stunning good looks. Seriously, someone that could do the job. Qualifications, proven track record.
Women in high positions when elected, do you think they govern differently than men?
Do I think they do? Yes, I do. But I think that they try to govern like men because it's a male-dominated arena. And so to fit in and to be, I'm afraid that they do.
Condition. What would she have to do to get your vote?
Run for office?
If a woman would run for office,
put her name on the ballot. And not be somebody that was just bogusly written in.
I am not a voter in this country.
Mm.
And yes, I would. Yeah.
What would she have to do to get your vote?
Yoga every morning.
She would have to show competence in politics.
That's what the VP is for.
Yeah, I think good qualities of a president, male or female, are that they keep their integrity and don't just put out rules and thoughts and speeches that happen to match the political rules of the time, but actually match their personality and come from themselves.
Do you think women in elected office govern differently than men?
Yes and no. I've been watching women politicians in Germany for quite a while, and interestingly enough, we do have since several years now the first woman president in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not watched it too closely, but I think women have a different quality of thinking, but I don't think it comes out in politics very much, because otherwise they wouldn't have gotten where they are.
That's a
more holistic kind of approach towards things versus fixating on one topic or several topics.
The speaker will be a strong person. To me, it's a feasible thing.
Yeah.
There could be somebody that wouldn't surprise me someday if that happened.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Whether it's feasible or not, but then to me, why not?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm a little behind the curve.
I would vote for a woman for president. I think there are just as many smart women out there as there are men. There are just as many qualified women. I would like to see our world be more fair. I don't want to see a male world. I would like to see a qualified world. I'd like to see a world where you're judged on what you can do and what you know and what experience you have and qualifications, more so than whether you're a man or a woman. I think women would make, I think a woman would make a very good president if she's qualified, as much as I think a man would make a good president if he was qualified. Probably the only way anyone would be successful is if they walk into the presidency not needing anything or wanting anything, so that no one had any power over them to sway their opinions. I think there are a lot of qualified women out there. I don't think they've ever had the backing in order to be able to accomplish it. I think Elizabeth Dole would have made an excellent president. I think she had everything that a president needed to be successful. She just didn't have the backing.
Do you think a woman, that women elected to office govern differently than men do?
I think that what most men are afraid of is that a woman would use her heart instead of her mind. But I think if you have a qualified person in there, they would both work together. I think a woman would be more concerned about social issues. I think she would be more concerned about jumping into conflict. I think that she might be more determined to find other ways before she would risk anyone's life. But I think she could be just as strong as a man. And I think if it called for drastic measures, she would jump right in and do it. If not, she shouldn't have the job.
Yeah.
You know, our country's the greatest country in the world, and we need to preserve it and appreciate it and protect it. Do you think a woman can do the job, Ed?
Yeah, have babies. I was joking.
Now, this is serious, though, Ed.
I know it.
But then answer seriously.
Yeah, that's true. I think that is true.
Would you vote for a woman president, Ed?
If I qualify.
That's a switch right there. That's remarkable.
But if they're not.
Would you vote for a woman for president, and if so, under what conditions? What would it take?
Yes, if it's not Hillary Clinton.
Okay, that's the answer and a condition. The other question is, do you think women elected to office govern differently than men do?
Yes. Absolutely. I think women in any managerial position act differently. I see a lot more team building, consensus building, actually taking into account others' opinions. I see it as judges listening more. Decisions seem to take longer to make, but more thought put into each decision, I think.
We're wrapping up with music from Russian musician Victoria Serginko. It's a piece called Maybe from her album Poetry Parade. Catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next week.
Somewhere, maybe I'll see. I will lay my head on your shoulder. I will cast my will's head. Maybe.